This is Sierra Dahl with Municipal Sustainability and Energy Forum, and today we're going to have a discussion about some of the developments of oil pipelines in the United States. Myra Moss from Ohio State University has been working on this. Myra, why don't you go ahead and take it over and go ahead and explain what you've been working on and what's happening.
Okay, thanks, Sierra. I appreciate that. I thought I'd maybe give you a little bit of my background and why I'm doing what I'm doing here, and how I became involved in this topic. I'm with Ohio State University Extension in community development, and my focus has been on sustainable community planning. And I serve the entire state of Ohio, basically trying to interpret research-based material for people out in communities so that they can use it, find it useful for their own lives, and meet the community's needs. So in 2010, the eastern part of the state went through started a Marcellus and Utica shale oil and gas boom. And now at this point in time, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and West Virginia, which is that basin, has become a major player in unconventional hydrocarbon development in the U.S., both gas and oil from shale. And what I've been doing is working with communities to address social, economic, and environmental impacts of shale development, trying to help them overcome what we fear may be another boom-bust cycle. We've already been through coal development and have experienced that, and actually even before coal, it was forestry. So we are a natural, that part of the state is a natural resource-based economy, so it tends to follow that boom-bust cycle. So what can we do to transcend that? And looking at how do we engage communities and stakeholders, then also how do we work with industry to understand what the whole, and I think actually they do understand the concept, but understand how they might be able to gain and maintain social license to operate, which basically is, and I'll explain it a little bit, but it's basically the community allowing them to do what they need to do without pushback and with a relationship based on trust. We're also looking at regulatory requirements, both FERC and then what the state regulatory environment is like. So looking at the impact of shale development on Appalachian Ohio, it certainly has been an economic boom at this point. It brought that region out of a long-term recession. They never recovered from the last national recession until the oil and gas industry came in. Our unemployment lower, per capita income is increasing. There's more jobs for youth, and so they can stay in the local community, which, of course, makes everyone very happy. And then farms are becoming economically viable, and we're seeing children take over their parents' farms, which is kind of a new trend, social trend, that we did not see before. So why is there a pipeline build-out now? And I talked to a colleague from the Ohio Farm Bureau this morning. He's kind of the ground zero on pipeline development in Ohio. And Ohio has at least three major interstate pipeline projects under construction with more to come. So we've been highly impacted by that. He works with landowners, farmers, local public officials, pipeline contractors, regulatory agencies, both at the state and federal level. And I tend to agree with him on this. He sees shale gas as a transitional fuel to bridge the gap between coal and renewables. In Ohio, we've historically generated most of our electricity from coal-fired plants, and we know what the impacts of that are. But we also feel renewable energy is not quite prepared to take over the complete need for power. So the issues that renewables need to address include storage, capacity of the electric service grid, other sorts of things that are going to really rely on evolving technology to be able to meet the potential. So what we're doing now is constructing gas-fired power plants because of the shale boom, gas boom, And there are 13 in the state that are built or under construction, and we're decommissioning our coal-fired plants. Also, we're seeing a growth in the utilization of compressed natural gas vehicles. The city of Columbus is using that to power their buses. So that has become also an increasing trend, using natural gas. Also, at the same time, one of our largest state investor-owned utilities is developing utility wind and solar installation. These are utility scale installations in various parts of the state. And they submitted a plan to the PUCO about a year ago that's going to double the amount of renewable energy in the state. Now, we're still far behind some other states, but we are, you know, making those steps to try to build toward our energy future as a state. So now we're entering the infrastructure development stage of unconventional hydrocarbon development. Infrastructure has been a real bottleneck. We started out in Ohio with companies coming in and actually, you know, building wells and pads, and hydraulic fracturing techniques were used to bring oil out of the shale, oil and gas out of the shale. The problem was there was a bottleneck. They were producing the product, but they couldn't get it to market. So we found that many wells were being capped and just, you know, kind of not used and not used for production anymore. So the key question became, how do you safely, efficiently, and sustainably move those oil and gas resources from where they're produced to the well at the wellhead to where they are used? In other words, their markets. And there are different transportation modalities for oil and gas, marine, rail, and, of course, pipeline. And pipelines, I think, are generally seen as being the safest, most efficient, and, if done correctly, the least environmentally impactful of the various transportation options. As a result, we're seeing growth in the development of the interstate pipeline and infrastructure system, and this is likely to continue until the needed infrastructure is built out. But, of course, this isn't happening without conflict and pushback, and it's kind of interesting because for a long time the pipeline companies kind of did their business, went on about their work quietly and kind of under the radar. And in the last few years, now they have become very high profile and they are in the headlines constantly with a lot of public pushback, legal issues, state issues. So it's something new, I believe, for the pipeline companies that they're trying to come to terms with. It's like, what are we doing wrong? What do we need to do right? So now, who regulates the pipelines and who has permanent power? And for interstate pipelines, it's, again, FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And then to complicate matters further, each state has their own regulations for intrastate pipelines and also impacts on the interstate. And those regulations are all over the board. We tend to think that Ohio's are better than the federal level and are encouraging through lobbying to try to get the federal FERC to start adhering or maybe looking more positively at some of the state guidelines. So what I wanted to do is share with you some preliminary research into the challenges and concerns regarding pipeline development. And I guess before I start that, are there any questions or comments? Okay, I'll go ahead then and start with the challenges. And first one is public and stakeholder concerns and oppositions. And as I said, pipeline companies are facing pushback by communities, stakeholders, and environmental interests and activists. The most probably intents of which range from, well, they range from impact to my individual property. So I am a farmer, and how are you going to impact my livelihood, to community impacts, environmental impacts, and those people who want to keep it in the ground because of concern about fossil fuel use and its impact on climate change. So the siting, permitting, and construction of pipelines is becoming more difficult due to this pushback and the increased sophistication and collaboration by those groups and individuals who are opposed to pipeline development and hydrocarbon development. So there are bans by various states, and there's also the increasing use of litigation. The approach has evolved from opposing upstream production, which would actually be the, you know, the drilling, to blocking or delaying the construction of infrastructure needed to bring the product to market. And what that does is that causes a delay in project construction that increases costs substantially. There are also the additional use of eminent domain and the question about, is this really for a public purpose? And questioning whether oil and gas, and especially when it's used for export markets, is for a public purpose, certainly at the domestic level. Another challenge is non-governmental organization considerations, which would be social and environmental NGOs, and they'll often voice concerns and offer feedback about wildlife, habitat destruction, forest fragmentation, aquatic impacts, crossing rivers, conservation, which also involves hunting lands, social, cultural, and historically sensitive areas, environmental justice, and more. There's also a disparity between benefits and costs, and this gets into the whole area of environmental justice and energy justice. And what we often see is that the communities that bear the costs, the environmental, social, and economic costs of pipeline development, do not share equally in the benefits of that pipeline development. You may have individual property owners who receive leases, but there's also lease payments, but there's also a lot of other kinds of impacts that the communities are not compensated for, like the need to expand their services or safety or housing or something similar to that, that is, that they're not they receive no benefit for. While some of the state's taxing structures do distribute revenues from pipeline development to communities, others don't. In Ohio, we have a severance tax, and that was used to reduce state income taxes across the board for everyone in the state. So it was not targeted to those communities who really, you know, could have used some assistance. Pennsylvania has an impact fee. Although that is, it's collected, you hear some criticism that it also is distributed too widely and not targeted to those communities that really are bearing the brunt of the development. North Dakota has a legacy fund. What pipeline developers now are doing more effectively is working with Native American populations, where the concern is what benefits are there to the community. So they're looking at things like hiring local labor, purchasing local goods and services in order for those populations to be able to share in the benefits. State-level political and legal obstacles, potential legal precedents, and statewide ballots create pipeline development uncertainties. Projects that have received FERC approval are not always guaranteed that state regulatory agencies or the courts will follow suit. So one example is the Constitution Pipeline in New York. There was also a recent ruling by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court that reaffirmed constitutional protections on clean air, pure water, and environmental preservation And this is creating uncertainties for energy development developers and may have some impact for development in the future. Colorado Proposition 112, I know, did not pass, but we are seeing more types of movements like that to try to curb oil and gas development. And, again, that all creates uncertainty. Increased costs due to delays in governmental policies. One thing that's affected the industry financially has been the tariffs on steel and aluminum and on imports of certain diameter pipes, and it increases the cost of pipeline projects substantially, and that adds to both the developers and the investors' financial uncertainties and you know, could be a problem. And gaps and overlaps in regulations, duplications and conflicts exist between different regulatory bodies and agencies and between different regulations themselves. They're not in sync with each other, and oftentimes they work at cross purposes or they ask for the same duplicative information. So that also creates conflicts and timeline discontinuity among those agencies and adds timing and uncertainty to the permitting process. So this risk and uncertainty and increased cost of delays has become a critical issue for both private pipeline companies and in their investors. Sierra, how am I doing on time?
I was just going to say we probably need to stop pretty soon here for questions.
Okay, why don't we do that? Because I really would like to, I mean, I'm still trying to determine what are the impacts and what are the kinds of concerns that exist out there so that they can be addressed through hopefully best practices or, you know, whatever kinds of means that might be effective. So why don't I just turn that over to you, Sierra, and you can facilitate some discussion.
Anybody have any comments? I want to just add one thing as far as Colorado's concerned, and sure, more towards fracking than pipelines. But, yes, 112 was defeated, mainly because the oil industry has so much money that they put ads on incessantly all day long, every station, totally not telling you what it was people were supposed to vote down, but telling them not to vote for that or they'd lose their jobs, basically. And so that is basically why it lost. And there's cities around here fighting really hard, trying to keep fracking out from the middle of the cities. And we have wells being drilled literally in the middle of town. And Boulder County's trying very hard to keep them out, but the government here are trying very hard not to allow them to do that. So it's been an interesting situation.
We're seeing the same thing happen in Ohio, Sierra, and the problem is that the way our state regulations are, they do have some awfully good things, but in terms of the actual fracking itself, the pipeline seems to be more heavily regulated by the state, where they're going to be, environmental impact, addressing farmland productivity, those sorts of things. But the actual well pads themselves, basically all the state needs is they need certain conditions met, but then the property owner has to be willing to lease their property. It's not in the hands of the regulators, and it's not in the hands of the community. It's actually the individual property owner. So
that would be nice if it was like that here in Colorado. It sure is not. The city has been trying to put out moratoriums on fracking, and they're not allowed to do that. So
okay.
Our governor has threatened to sue the cities if they didn't allow the oil companies to come in. And we have a Democratic governor. So anyhow, anybody else? Comments? Anybody?
I'm sorry. I had to unmute. I was wondering.
And do you want to introduce yourself, please?
Oh, sorry. It's John Walter.
Okay, sure.
I'm wondering whether is there any argument to be made for the addition of pipelines increasing the resiliency of the transportation and of the energy business?
Can you say more about that?
Well, I mean, in my mind's eye, I'm thinking that if there are pipelines that that eliminate the prospect of a single point of failure, by increasing the network, you increase the resiliency of the entire network.
Yeah, that's definitely a consideration, and I have some colleagues who are actually looking into the whole issue of resiliency. And, yeah, definitely that is seen as being a positive, you know, that would be the case. So that argument, though, I am not as involved with as I am at the arguments at the community level, but it would seem to me that that might be an argument that could be used to help address some of the issues that we're hearing at the state and federal level.
Any other
Very
comments?
Good. And let me ask one more question, if I don't.
Sure.
Long distance boring, underground boring, you know, directional boring, is that being looked into as an alternative to surface pipelines?
Not that I know of, but you're basically talking about what they'll do with highways. When they want to put something underneath a highway, they'll do a directional boring, right?
Yes, that's right, right.
Okay. Yeah, I have not heard anything about that, and I know that certainly the pipeline development in Ohio, what I'm familiar with has actually been, you know, the trenching, the traditional trenching. So I don't know, but that's a good thing to bring up. I know that in terms of technology, that's a huge issue right now with pipelines. How can you make them safer? You know, how can you more effectively monitor them? How can you use construction techniques that will make them less impactful on the environment? And I would think that that would certainly be something that would be that needs to be looked at if it's not already.
Very good. And I can pause and let other people ask, but I have more questions, so I'll wait for others.
Yeah, we'll see. Anybody else have any comments? Craig, you're always good for something. All right, John, go ahead.
Okay. So the next question is, how important or instrumental is the, and I can't remember the name of the fault, but there's a major fault that goes through Ohio. Is that a big consideration in planning pipeline routes and construction?
Yeah, and I know what you're talking about. I am aware we actually had an earthquake a number of years ago on that particular fault. What we have seen is there were some seismicity issues, but this was more from fracking, and actually it was not only fracking, it was injection wells, that we saw the injection well process stimulating small faults and creating some earthquakes in the Youngstown area. I have not heard anything about the major fault that goes through Ohio. My guess is that would be something that is being dealt with, because I know at this point in time they're requiring that the state is requiring that the seismicity that sensors be placed around where the wells are going anyway. I've not heard much about pipelines, but where the wells are going, in order to determine if there are any changes or any seismic activity.
Anybody else?
Yeah, Myra, this is Lori Schell. A question on, just based on your research and how the strategies seem to be evolving over time, if you were consulting to the proponents of a new pipeline or to the opponents of a new pipeline, what kind of advice would you give to each in terms of the most effective strategy, whether you're opposing or whether you're for, and then kind of from the other side, how best to kind of meet that strategy?
Okay. My take on that is that a strategy, either if you're opposed or you're in favor, it needs to be a collaboration between the industry, the community, and the regulators. And I'm not sure that that's happening to the extent it should. So what my recommendation would be to a community is, whether they're opposing it or in favor of it, is to reach out to the industry, try to develop a relationship with them, develop effective means of communication back and forth so that the community knows exactly what's happening, and so that the residents are very much aware. Inspection is critical. Insist on more effective inspection, both by FERC and by the companies, and basically build that relationship. Now, a lot of that is aimed toward the industry developing that relationship and really taking the whole concept of social license to operate seriously and knowing exactly what that means and exactly what needs to happen in order to maintain that, to gain it in the first place and then to maintain it. So the critical factor is community engagement and engagement between the company, the community, and the regulators.
Great, thank you.
Myra has to leave pretty soon here, so go ahead with another question here. And Myra, it's almost on the half hour, so I'm leaving it up to you.
Okay. This is David.
Yeah, sure. Go ahead, David. Uh-huh.
I also have to leave in just a minute. Hi, Myra. My question is, based on the work you, sort of your own research, plus kind of what you've learned about the issues, which topical areas do you as an educator, when you're in your education role, feel are the areas in which there's the most uncertainty about, from a science perspective on where, what educators should be telling community members and industry for that matter? So, like, I'm, for example, particularly concerned about the questions of, which I haven't, I followed up a little recently, but used to follow very closely, about methane emissions and the contribution of methane emissions to global warming, particularly not just from the pipelines, but from the, not just from the fracking process, but from the pipelines themselves. That'd be one. Or another one that's contested a lot around here is sort of the fundamental question of, to what extent is infrastructure investment pipelines locking us into a longer-term horizon of use of another fossil fuel as opposed to truly being a bridge fuel. So I'm not saying you should say those. I'm just saying those are ones I'm still curious about whether the research has really answered those very well. But from your perspective, which ones are the ones that you wish you had better answers to?
Oh, boy, where do I start? I think one critical thing is I agree with you on methane. That is a critical issue, and I think a lot more needs to be research needs to happen on that. And not only research, but also the technology needs to be developed further so that it can be detected early if there is a leak, and it can be dealt with more effectively. So certain things like use of drones along pipeline corridors or use of pigs, which actually go inside the pipeline itself and determine the integrity or are able to monitor the integrity of the pipeline. So I would say technology is going to be critically important. And that's something that I think some of the technologies are just emerging. And the more that can happen to actually bring those along, I think are going to help substantially. I guess another one that I've got is I'm concerned about habitat fragmentation and what happens when a pipeline is built across forested lands, which we're seeing quite a bit of in Ohio. I think more research needs to be built into best practices or alternatives to that. Then another thing I'm concerned about, wish I had more information on best practices, would be agricultural lands and the impact on agricultural productivity. Looking at soil compaction, soil characteristics, what can be done to mitigate some of those impacts.
Good. Thank you very much. I have to go, but I would just comment additionally that some of the kinds of things that we're talking about are also impacts of renewable energy. And we're doing some work, for example, on solar, the build-out of solar in New York, which banned fracking, of course.
Right.
You know, some of the same questions, certainly not all of them, are also salient in other energy areas.
I agree with you, especially when you're looking at wind energy. We've done a little bit of research on wind energy and impact on bird migration. I'm not sure there's any energy source that does not have some kind of negative impact on the environment.
Myra, do you know much about the impact of the fossil fuel industry on birds?
On birds?
Yeah, they always talk about the wind industry, but what about the fossil fuel industry and their impact on the bird population?
Know much about that. I mean, other than
yeah, that would be a really good thing to know.
I think so. Yeah.
You know, how does it compare with the wind, for instance? Is it, more or less? I mean, it's always brought up with the renewables, but not fossil fuels. I wanted to let you know that it is 3:34 your time.
Okay, I'm gonna have to probably disappear then for a while, but
I know. So thanks so much for coming. I'm not trying to get rid of you, but I know you need to leave, so.
Right. Okay, thanks a lot.
That was great. Thank you very much for your insights.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for your contributions. Bye.
Thanks so much,
bye-bye.
Myra. Bye-bye now. So anybody else have any comments on this topic?
I appreciate you finding it. It's as the gentleman said, I appreciate the insights because we have to be aware of the impacts of any generation. It wasn't very long ago that natural gas was the panacea to dirty air, you know, from coal and oil. And so in some ways, it certainly is the bridge between totally renewable and a sort of a sustainable pathway. So I appreciate this topic.
Yeah, there's a lot of things going on in Colorado in that area. We've had homes exploding in different areas from them not capping the pipelines correctly after they abandoned them. We've had, drilling extremely close to buildings and schools, which is what 112 was supposed to be about, but the oil industry has enough money to prevent most of these regulations from occurring. So, and you know, they won't allow the cities to have anything, a long-term moratorium on fracking. It can have short-term, but after that they're fighting their way into something that's more permanent. And they just, trying to keep these people from being right inside the cities, which we have, even between here and Longmont. You see wells anywhere in the middle of all these different counties right around cities. You're having all these fracking wells. And, you know, the emissions and the health hazards that nobody talks about related to fracking, besides just the methane going into the air and climate change. So we don't hear about these things. One reason is that nobody has the money to publicize them. So anyway,
well,
anybody
you can look at the economic approaches to price the future liabilities, and I don't see that done very often. It's one thing to establish all the rules. It's another thing to make to establish and make law consequences of liabilities that go beyond the lifespan of a company or entity.
Oh, I totally agree. But the problem you have with the oil industry is that they have enough money that they can scare people. And what we had with 112 was just ad after ad, all day long, every station, every hour, literally, I'm not exaggerating, on telling people they're going to lose their job. They didn't tell what it was. They just said, don't vote for it. You're going to literally telling them they'll lose, major people are going to lose their jobs, they'll be out of work, you know, they're going to shut down all these industries, and it just over and over, all these different ethnic ads, ads with, just everything. And ads that hit every type of person, every type of male and female, they were so good at it. It was real obvious it wasn't going to win, but people had no idea what they were voting down. They had no clue that the fracking could end up right next to their home. They had no idea because they didn't want them to. And it's just, that's kind of what we're dealing with in this country. So, anyhow.
Right.
So anybody else have any comments here?
Sierra, I would just, as a fellow Coloradan, I'm not sure you're giving the citizens enough credit, or maybe it's because I'm down here in the San Juan Basin that, you know, I felt like people were pretty, you know, did have an idea of what they were voting for with 112.
I don't think a lot of people, I think there's a certain, you know, actually there were a lot more that voted for it than I thought would. I agree with you on that. I was surprised there were as many that did vote for it.
Yeah.
But, you know, a lot of people just don't have time with mother with kids. They don't have time to do the research to find out what this really is that they're voting for.
Right.
And I think
that may be just a Southwest Colorado versus Flint Range perspective, because I felt like the people here in La Plata County, you know, voted for 112, whereas, you know,
oh, really? That's interesting that they would in that area. Wow.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Very good.
Yeah.
Dan
anyway.
Boulder obviously did, but then a lot of the rest of Denver voted it down, you know.
Right, right.
You know, you just, like I said, a lot of people, well, they just did a good smear job. They just did.
Yeah.
And they're very good at it.
Yeah.
So, and that's pretty much what people are facing in all over the country right now. So anyhow, no, I agree with you, though. I think it had a more people voting for it than I would have expected, considering the amount of marketing that was done in opposition. So, anybody else? Okay. Well, we'll go ahead and call it a day here, and we're going to have another conference call on CCA on December 6th, I believe it is, Friday. Yeah, on Thursday, December 6th. And so be looking for the announcements. You should already have had something on your calendar about that. So I'll be sending
yes, thank you. Looking forward to that one as well. Thank you very much.
All right. Super. Thanks, everybody, for coming, and we'll see you next time.
Bye.
Thanks, you. Bye-bye.